for years and years when I lived at a monastery in England, and I was the second or third monk in the community. It was always the abbot, Ajahn Sumedho, who was the bell ringer. So I used to do this as a practice for every sitting, that I would give myself the reflection that, okay, this is the last 45 minutes or hour of my life, and then when the bell rings, to notice what am I hanging on to, what's my mind preoccupied with, and then can I drop it before the sound fades. And it, coincidentally, we actually had the identical kind of bell. This is a fire alarm bell. An Amaravati monastery in England, they also had like an old fire alarm from the school that one of the nuns had painted up, but it was exactly the same bell and the same sound. So it actually, this very bell brings back that same practice to my mind. I guess maybe that triggered the memory. But it's revealing, isn't it? It's kind of interesting what the mind preoccupies itself with. You know, that weekend in August, everything's happening then. Well, we're presuming we're going to be there, that we're going to still be there in August, and that we're going to be around for that. But if we've breathed our last on July the 11th, then what happens on August the 3rd? Won't be the top of our list, I wouldn't think. So this evening, I thought I'd offer some general reflections on the themes of death and dying and Buddhist practices around that, and then would like to open things up and have a good time for dialogue in the latter part of the evening. Well, one of the reflections that that comes up, one of the things that comes up with this kind of meditation, where, like, if that bell at the end of the sitting, if that really was the end of my life, if I really did have 10 minutes left, you know, what are the important things? And I remember about maybe 13, 14 years ago, just after my father died, it was a strange thought that crossed my mind. He hadn't been particularly ill. He had a heart attack many years before, but he'd been pretty good health for many years. And suddenly, he collapsed and turned out to have a ruptured aorta. And so he was bleeding internally for a couple of days. So the family managed to gather around him just before he died, and so we were all there with him when he passed away. And one of the first thoughts that crossed my mind after he died was, he was right. He didn't have to go to the dentist. Because he was always grumbling. He was really hated going to the dentist. And my mother was always sort of gently harassing him, like, you know, that he really ought to pay more attention to his teeth and get them fixed. And he would always find excuses to not go. And I thought, Dad was right. He didn't have to go, you know. He died without his teeth being fixed. So it was a strange thought, but you know, in a way, it was one of those things that crosses the mind, and yet somehow we know that's significant. Because how many things in our lives do we preoccupy ourselves with? I've got to do this and got to do that, and I haven't really sorted that out, and I really should, and it's my duty to X, Y, Z. And how much of our mental space is taken up with our preoccupations of what we've got to do, or what we have already done, and carrying this large baggage around. And then we don't realize how much of that depends on the idea that I've got so many weeks, months, years to play with. But then when you cut it down to a few minutes or an hour or so, then what happens to our priority list? It's a radical shake-up. Another occasion where this came to mind was some years ago. I had a mole that went kind of haywire, or got very large very rapidly, and so I came to the, it was actually just after we opened the monastery here in Redwood Valley. And so I went down to see the good Dr. McClintock, our local dermatologist, and he said, okay, what's the problem? And in true uncomplicated rural doctor style, he sort of took one look and said, lie down. took a photograph and got the anesthetic out, pumped in some anesthetic, got out the scalpel and cut the mole out then and there. I thought, oh, well, obviously he thought that was worth doing. There wasn't a lot of discussion about that. It was literally one look, lie down. So, okay, well, that was interesting. And so then he said, well, I'll send this off to the lab. It'll be about a week before we get the results back, and they'll let us know whether it's cancerous or not. And just the year before, a friend of ours had had melanoma and had had this whole major scare about that. And so that the doctor said it might be melanoma, but we don't know. We don't know what stage it's at, because it was pretty impressive. And so we'll get the results back in a week. So this is like, so I've been a Buddhist monk for a long time, do a lot of Dharma teaching, endlessly discoursing about aging and death and the imminence of death and you know, all of these kind of wonderful sets of teachings and reflections. And suddenly, oh, me too. Oh. And then all of these sort of wonderful lists of qualities and these kind of interesting stories and examples from the scriptures and that, suddenly it's like, oh, this feels very different. It's got my name on it. And coincidentally, I was scheduled to go and take part in a week-long conference on compassion at Esalen Institute right during that week. So I was right there in Esalen, and it's a very wonderful place, Esalen Institute. But it does tend to attract people who are rather concerned with themselves. In a somewhat kind of fussy way on occasion, and so I must confess that there was these profound urges after with people sort of talking about their own difficulties and struggles. There was this very powerful urge to say, well, "You think you've got problems, you know? Let me tell you, you know." But I could see that the energy behind that was not incredibly liberated, and I restrained myself until it actually sort of just sort of came up naturally. The last evening I was going to be there, it came up. It was in conversation. It was sort of coaxed out of me. So it did actually get onto the recordings for the conference, but it was after I'd had to work with the urges to restrain myself. But it was a very powerful week for me, because that's just as in this little exercise in the last 10 minutes of the sitting, it just was an extraordinary sort of flood of feedback on my life. I just opened this new monastery. It's got my name, you know, like my name's on the nameplate, you know. Like, I was supposed to be starting this new place up, and then, oh, maybe I'm not even going to be around for it. And then all these book projects. I mean, I kind of always have writing projects of one kind or another. Like, oh, all these manuscripts. What if I'm not going to be around? Because there's this friend of ours who'd had melanoma the year before. She'd gone to the doctor, and they said, well, you know, this is a recurrent melanoma, so that there's no cure for it. It can't be treated. You've probably got 6 or 7 months to live. You know that you have to look at the fact that you're probably going to die before Christmas. And that's the fact. That's the way melanoma works. If it comes back, as a very unique pathology amongst cancers. If it comes back, it comes back everywhere. At once, basically, has a sort of unique way of working, and if it recurs, if you had it once and it comes back again, then there's no treatment possible, really. So that's why if you see me around, I'm often wearing kind of sun hats and sun gloves and a smell of sunscreen. Sorry, I'm not carrying sympathy, or not aiming to carry sympathy. this evening, but it's used as an example. There was this friend of ours who, and actually, as it turned out, that she had been misdiagnosed, and it was not recurrent melanoma, but she just had it for the first time. So if you look after it and don't let it recur, then you can live an ordinary life. But if it's come back, then that's it. You're in Act 5, Scene 5. Exeunt. So anyway, what the experience of that week was that my list of priorities had a radical shake-up. And it really came alive, no pun intended, that this is, it's got our name on it. And this is talking about us. And it really gave a powerful feedback on what's really important. What do I want to have my mind on? What am I habitually spending my attention on? That doesn't really matter. If I am going to be dead by Christmas, then does this really matter? Will the world survive without one more book? Well, those unresolved conflicts. Well, they just have to pass unfinished. And I remembered a statement by a friend of ours, a guy I know in England, who used to say, "When you take a boat out of the water, it doesn't leave a dent." That there's this feeling that somehow the universe needs me, that I'm this unexpendable piece, and that if I'm not in the picture, then there's going to be this large dent. And amazingly enough, the universe is actually very fluid. And when you take a boat out of the water, it doesn't leave a dent there. The world just flows right in and life carries on. So what this was revealing, these kind of experiences and these practices reveal is there's, and as most of us are probably fully aware, there's this profound instinct in us to reject the actuality of death, that as human beings, and as in the little blurb for this this evening, it's actually a quote from the Mahabharata, and it's in the third section of the Mahabharata. If some of you know the story of this great Indian epic, and the five brothers, the Pandavas, have been exiled off, and they're living in this forest. And at one point, they have come to this lake called the Lake of Death, and four of the five brothers have all collapsed and died because of this yaka, this sort of celestial demon that was guarding the lake, and they'd sort of transgressed in one way or another. And then there's this voice from the mist, the yaka who's guarding the lake, then pounds the prince Yudhishthira with this series of questions, like dozens and dozens of these philosophical, ethical questions. And Yudhishthira has to answer all these questions and basically get them right to pass the test. And so this question was one of them that the voice from the mist asks him, which is, what is the most strange and wonderful thing in the world? And Yudhishthira responds, "The most strange and wonderful thing in the world is that even though every single human being that's ever been born has entered or will surely enter the halls of death, every one of us thinks that it will not happen to us." And for a slightly more updated version of that, in I think it's in Slaughterhouse 5, the wonderful Kurt Vonnegut, the sage of our age, the Tralfamadorians, these beings from another planet, another galaxy, a Tralfamadorian has been marooned on Earth and is trying to send a signal back to Tralfamador to get a spare part for his or her or its spaceship. And one of the things that this Tralfamadorian discovers is that human beings only live for 70 or 80 years. And a Tralfamadorian's lifespan is about 30,000 years. And one of the messages that this little critter sends back, she says, "It's amazing. They just live for the most brief finger snap of time." Or whatever kind of fingery type things that the Tralfamadorian has. And yet, it's amazing. They're hardly alive for any time at all, but they just carry on as if it wasn't all going to be over, just before they hardly even started. It's incredible. I don't know how they do it. They're all so cheerful most of the time. They just get up and go to work and kind of have holidays and cook the breakfast and just sort of carry on as if it wasn't all going to be over just before they've hardly even started. Isn't it amazing? So it's sort of Vonnegut's version of that same encounter. So what we experience is that we have a very profound capacity for switching off the fact that we can all die at any particular moment, and that it's, even if things go well, that the most we can look forward to is 120 years of life, and probably the latter few years are not going to be terribly comfortable if we do make it to 120. That we can somehow put that off into the distance and carry on to go to work with our lives and our days and our work and our families and so forth. And it's also it's important to recognize, I feel, that it's not just a human trait, but you know, all animals in certainly from the mammals side of things, that we have a profound and instinctual rejection of death. That death is horrifying and appalling to us. That there's a natural instinct, a profound instinct that makes us pull away from death. And that the rejection of death, or the denial of death in our thoughts, is really just an extension of the avoidance of death and the fear of death that is there even in animals that don't do a lot of thinking, like simple mammals and other creatures. Have a similar powerful repulsion towards death, so that the smell of a dead body of your own species, or the sight of an injured or a mutilated body of our own species is particularly horrifying. You know, of course, you know, scientists have done all kinds of tests to show this is the case, but the smell of a dead human body is far more repulsive and painful and shocking than of another animal. That we know that this is something bad and dangerous has happened, and that the instinct, even if the mind can't think those thoughts, the instinct is a protective one, which is something nasty has happened here, get away or you could be next. That's in a very simplistic but I feel accurate way, that's one of the causes behind the denial of death and the rejection of death, the fear of death, is like, yeah, be afraid, because the ones that weren't afraid were the ones that got eaten next. The ones that didn't get out of the way of the rock fall. The ones that didn't avoid eating that particular, the bush, the berries from that particular bush that were lethal. So I think it's important to see that the fear of death or the rejection, the denial of death, comes from a natural and very, very useful protective instinct. It's not a neurotic problem. It's what's helped us to be the ones that are alive. The ones that didn't follow those signals were the ones that didn't make it. So that it's important to understand that's a natural instinct. But when we allow that then to be something that we kind of take on unconsciously as a dominant principle or as a guiding principle in our lives, that's when we get into trouble. Like that the fact that we're really not prepared for that, or we feel that something unfair has happened when someone close to us dies, or when we are facing, you know, inescapably and vividly our own demise, that there's something in us, that same denial or rejection of death feels that something's gone wrong or something unfair has happened. You know, why me, or why now? This isn't fair. And in one of their books, I forget whether it was Stephen Levine or Ram Dass, you know, famously recounted a dialogue of this nature with a guy who was 91 or 93 years old. They were working in a hospice. I think it was Ram Dass. And this guy says, you know, it's not fair. You know, why me? He says, Harry, you're 93 years old. You know, I don't think you're asking the right question. So that it's where that protectiveness and that kind of aversion to death then spills over, and then we take it to heart. We really feel that, yeah, somehow I really am going to get away from this. This isn't right. This isn't fair. This shouldn't be happening. Something terrible and bad has gone wrong. And that that's where we start to really suffer. We make life difficult for ourselves. That it's that kind of feeling that somehow the universe is out of order, And it is conceptually, it's very difficult for us, and particularly in theistic religions and a theistic condition, and saying that that somehow you have the right to live a long and comfortable life, and that if you die young, then something, then God is treating you badly, or that something unfair and terrible has happened. From the Buddhist point of view, it's a bit more blunt, but you don't have the principle of a creator deity who is trying to make everything comfortable and pleasant for everybody all of the time. It's more like we're born and therefore we're subject to the whole natural order. And if you look around, you know, you see that living beings, you know, some creatures die young, some live to the middle of their lives, and some of them get old, but you don't see a lot, as I often point out, you know, you don't see a lot of old birds. I mean, how many of you have you seen a turkey vulture walking along the road because, you know, it's too old to flap its wings? You know, the feathers are going grey, and it's like can't really kind of get the altitude anymore, can't get the flap going, so I'll just walk, you know. I mean, they don't. They cease to make it. So in the natural, so seeing ourselves as more as ordinary beings, as part of a natural order that are born and that we can live short or medium or long lives, but there's no special dispensation for humans or special plan for humans. So this is more than, you know, the Buddhist take on things. So I'm also open to other input and reflections on this. So that what Buddhist practice is then a lot to do with is still the aim of a spiritual life is that of, as you have in many other religions, it is the quality of liberating the heart, of freeing ourselves from the clutches of death, as it were. But not through denying it, or not through just some kind of hope, creating a hopeful philosophy to hang on to, but instead recognizing that there is an element in us that is unborn, undying, that is eternal, that is transcendent, and that that's there from before birth and is there after. It's outside of time in reality. It's not bound by time, and so. Just when we talk about Buddhist practice, when we talk about, say, the conquest of death, from a Buddhist point of view, it's to do with realizing that spiritual quality in us, that immortal quality, that unborn, undying quality of our own nature, that's already here. And so it's recognizing that the reason why we are shocked and horrified by the idea of a physical death, you know, the death of the body, is because we're identifying with the body. We take hold of the thought, I am the body, I am the personality, I am a woman, I'm a man, I'm old, I'm young, I'm tall, I'm short, I am this. And we create that as the limit of our world. And so much of Buddhist meditation is pointed towards saying, well, that's just one point of view, or that's just one angle of it, one aspect of it. But actually, there are these other dimensions of our being. And in particular, that in us which is transcendent, that which is unborn, undying, and which is never bound by the realm of birth and death. So maybe this is a subject for a whole other evening and other teachings. But this is the basic principle, and that's why when the Buddha, when he was a prince, and it was through seeing the presence of aging and sickness and death, and the shock and the horror of that, the kind of realizing, gee, is this going to happen to everybody? Wow, that's terrible. When he, in the myth of the Buddha's life, seeing an old person, a sick person, and a dead person, then, gee, is this going to happen to everyone? Because he led a very protected life. You know, his father had made sure that he never saw any old people or sick people or dead bodies. Whisked out all of those from the view of his son, and then when he saw them by going against his father's wishes, then he was shocked and horrified. But then the last of the four messengers, the four heavenly messengers, was that of the religious seeker. So when he asked his charioteer, okay, well, well, who's this person? A sort of a yogi in a loincloth, you know, walking along the street with an alms bowl. He says, oh, that's a seeker after the deathless. That's a yogi, a samana, a religious seeker. So what's he doing? He says, well, he's seeking the way beyond death. Oh, so you can do that, can you? Oh, yes. That's what the religious path is about. So then the Buddha considered, why should I, subject to aging, sickness, and death, why should I also chase after those things which are also subject to aging and sickness and sorrow and death? Why should I not seek the unaging, the unailing, the undying, the deathless? So I did. I decided I will seek the unaging, the undying, the unborn, the deathless. So, so much, even though so much of our instinct is to protect ourselves against death, you know, that the, that even here in California, there's a new aphorism has arisen that 60 is the new 40.
Yeah.
I'm 50, but so I've got another 10 years before I have to employ that one. And it's true, you know, we do live a lot longer, and our whole relationship to the aging process is quite different. But still, there is a kind of denial of death in our culture. You know, I remember seeing an advert for a white-haired guy with a beard and standing next to a very fancy Harley Davidson, and it was actually an advert for an insurance company. But the headline for the advert was "Grow old disgracefully." It's about a retirement plan and an insurance company. So there are all different kinds of ways that we deny death. And certainly, you know, there's no harm in extending our life and living as full a life as we possibly can. But if we feel that somehow, if we just do all the right things and take the right vitamins and have the right exercise routine, that somehow, you know, it's not going to happen to me, then we've really lost it. We're missing out on the fact that, yeah, it's everyone enters the temple of death. Every one of these bodies, 10 years, 10 minutes, 20 years, 50 years, 100 years, every one of us, every one of these bodies is going to go up in smoke or into the ground or whatever it will do. But they're not going to last, you know. Fact. Yeah. But, and so that, rather than taking the kind of threatening quality, because even if I say that, you know, it's like, oh dear, now it's getting grim, it's all getting sort of heavy and dark, and all these Buddhist monks, they're all kind of nihilists, really. It's not, there's a very, very subtle but extremely important line between nihilism and realism. It's like, yeah, all of these bodies are going to stop breathing one day. But the point is that that is not a problem. It's only if we identify with them as being totally who and what we are, the entirety of who and what we are, then it's a problem. But the Buddha's teaching points out these are not wholly and totally who and what we are. There are dimensions of our being that transcend that. So what the Buddhist meditation points us to is that a lot of the problem is that sense of denial within us and fearing death, running away from death, negating it. And that it's actually a counterintuitive move that we need to make, which is rather than negating, hating, fearing, resenting death and doing what we can to sort of placate it and keep it at a distance and pretend it's not really there or dress it up, like, you know, even and I apologize if anyone here is in the funeral home business, but, you know, even when we're in our coffins, you know, people get dressed up looking like they're on their way to the prom. You know, your best dress and kind of all the makeup. I mean, people who never wore makeup in the last 30 years, suddenly there they are in their coffin and they've got their, to their great chagrin, they're finally forced into wearing makeup. You know, so even after death, we're still denying death. But there's this counterintuitive move, is to turn towards that and say, yes, this is what's going to happen. This is the fact. There's no need to be afraid. Because this is not totally who and what we are. And there's a wonderful story in the Buddhist tradition, kind of the archetypal story, where a woman who had for many, many years longed to have a child and was unable to give birth, and then finally, to her great delight, gave birth to a son. Her name was Kisa Gotami. So she was from the same clan as the Buddha. Her name was Gotama. So Kisa Gotami means lean or skinny Gotami. The woman from the Gotama clan, the kind of lean Gotami. So she was a tall, thin type. So she had finally had this child and loved this child very, very dearly and adored him. And then, the child was still quite young, then he caught an illness and died. And she was she loved her child so much and was so attached to him that she couldn't accept the fact that he died. And so that then she she was desperate and heartbroken and couldn't find any doctor to cure the child. Because he died, he was already dead. And I said, no, your child is dead. There's no cure. The child has already died. So then in desperation, she was asking around, you doctors are useless. I'm going to try and find someone else. And she'd heard of the Buddha and his great powers. And so she took her child to the Buddha, the Jetavana, and brought her child to the Buddha and said, my child is sick. They say he's dead, but I don't believe it. I'm sure you can heal him. And the Buddha said, yes, I can. But I can help your child. But you must get something for me. And she said, what's that? Whatever it is, I'll get it. He said, I just need a grain of mustard. Just one mustard seed. Just one mustard seed, that's all you need? You're going to save my child? He says, yes. And she said, but on one condition, you have to get it from a house where nobody has ever died. So just bring me the mustard seed and come back and then I'll help your child. So she goes racing off into the town and she calls at the first house and says, my child is sick, can you help me? All I need is a grain of mustard seed. Can you help me? She says, oh sure, we've got mustard seed. They give her the seed and she says, oh, by the way, did anyone ever die in this house? Oh, of course, yeah, Uncle Harry died last week. Oh, okay, then the next house, the same house. Oh yeah, well, a month ago, my mother died. Oh, okay. Next house. Oh yeah, we had a terrible illness here. Three of my brothers and sisters died only 6 months ago. And after another. She goes through many, many houses in the city of Savatthi, and then slowly it dawns on her: there's no house in this town, in this great city, where nobody has ever died. This happens to everyone. And as she's continuing her search, then she slowly and gently awakens to the fact that what's happened to my son has happened to everybody. It's happened everywhere. And so then she comes back eventually to the Jetavana to see the Buddha. And she says, I realize that you've helped my child and you've helped me in the best way possible. I realize that death is here for everyone. And that she thanked him profoundly. And then in due course, she went forth and took refuge with the Buddha and became a nun and then became an arahant, a fully enlightened being. That she is one of, and then she became one of the foremost leaders of the nuns' community and a great enlightened master in her own right. And was very much loved and treasured by the community. And so that story is often told, and it indicates or characterizes the practice of that turning towards and accepting the fact of it. Because it's like turning towards your own shadow. It's like when you're running from your own shadow, it looks like something threatening. When you turn towards it and face it, you realize, oh, it's just my shadow. It's nothing to be afraid of. So again, and these practices sometimes seem a bit blunt to people, but one of the daily recollections that the Buddha encouraged is to consider, I am of the nature to age, I have not gone beyond aging. I am of the nature to sicken, I have not gone beyond sickness. I am of the nature to die, I have not gone beyond dying. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. I am the owner of my karma, born of my karma, related to my karma, abide supported by my karma. Whatever karma I shall do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. Thus we should frequently recollect. Now, even just hearing those words, you might think, gee, that's really depressing. Well, it's depressing to the ego. It's really threatening to that sense of me that wants to be in charge of everything and happy and stable forever. But if you notice underneath that the ego that feels, the I feeling that is threatened, there's something in the heart that says, duh, of course. That's the fact of it. And so it's not because the Buddha wanted us to be depressed. He said, five subjects for frequent recollection, ha ha ha, I'm going to make you all miserable. It's like, no, five subjects for frequent recollection, so that when we turn towards that shadow, we can realize, oh, who's afraid? What's there really to be afraid of? This is just the way of nature. There's nothing to be afraid of. And in that turning towards the fact of our aging and death and dying and that of those around us, even though it's not going to be sweet, it's a bitter taste, there's something in our heart knows, oh, it's just a bitter taste. And we can feel in that, that relaxation, the peace that lies beyond that. So the last thing I'd like to say then is one of the chants that we do at a funeral is Anicca Vata Sankara Upadavaya Damino Upajitava Nirujanti Tesang Upasamo Sukho. This is the most frequently recited reflection on impermanence. Anicca Vata Sankara, all conditioned things are impermanent. Upadavaya Dhamino, of the nature to arise and cease. Upajitava Nirujanti, having come into being, they naturally must fade away. Te sang upasamo sukho, and in their passing is peace. So, even when it's our own body or our own reputation, because of course there are small deaths and large deaths. Some of us are more frightened of ego death than we are of physical death, like failing publicly. I'm sure most of you know that the fear of public speaking was number one on the list of human fears, above nuclear war, above being murdered, above being raped or having all your possessions stolen or losing a family member. Public speaking is number one fear. So ego death can be more threatening than physical death. But if we watch the arising and ceasing, then as things fade and cease, as they come to an end, then if we stay with it, we realize in that fading, in that cessation, there's peacefulness. And not a piece of numbness, but a piece of expansiveness and a piece of delight. And so that it's a mysterious thing, but it's by learning to turn towards death and to embrace it, to face it, then we realize the peace beyond it. But as long as we're running from it, rejecting it, negating it, criticizing it, blaming it, fearing it, then we empower it, and create anxiety and threat within our hearts. So I offer these thoughts for consideration, and please raise any questions. And yes, there's a hand already.
Can you share your experience the last 3 or 4 minutes as you're going into that depth of Dham, what your experience and what your focus is, and on that little song you were saying about things that come into being,
mm-hmm. Isn't that incorrect? Doesn't being continue? I like
the analogy of taking the boat out of the water, nothing is
really gone. Well, just to respond to the first bit first, was my own experience was the realization, well, if this really was the last 3 minutes of my life, I wouldn't have to give a Dhamma talk this evening. So that's why I said that. It's like, oh, that. You know, so I was engaging in the practice in the same way, and then just a sense of, well, what am I hanging on to? Is there something that I feel there's left to do? Is there a regret of things done that you know, I wish I hadn't done? What is that? So there's that inquiry, that asking of questions, and there's seeing what arises. And so I felt a quality of gratitude for the wonderful opportunities I've had in this life. I didn't feel any regrets. I felt amusement. That would be interesting. that would be a make for a memorable evening. It's like, boy, that Ajahn Amaro takes his teaching seriously. He just, you know, he rang the bell and then just sat there. We were all waiting for the Dhamma talk, and that was it. He was gone. He's such an attention seeker. That would probably even make the front cover of the Ukiah Daily Journal, that one. Buddhist monk terminates life for the sake of making an impactful teaching. But you would remember it, wouldn't you? Could he die? Indeed so, yeah. Now what did he do? So the other piece is like, it's... it's using a language like saying being continues. It's almost like, and again, I don't want to get too complicated about it, but the word continues, in a way, it's implying a sense of a thing that's carrying on through time. But in the fundamental truth of that in our nature, which is transcendent, is really outside of time, is beyond time, so that continuing, the word continues doesn't really completely apply. And so that, and in Buddhist, the Buddhist philosophy of speaking about birth and death, you can say that when, because Buddhists talk about, you know, being in past lives and future lives and being reborn and such like, but what is born in that context is reborn is habits. You know, what you love, what you hate, what you're familiar with. That like there's a momentum of habit, of karma that carries on. When there is a full realization or a full and complete wisdom and understanding of the nature of things, of our own nature, of the nature of life itself, then that understanding leads to a complete freedom from entanglement and attachment of habits. And so that then, and we would say there's a letting go of any identification with the world of birth and death. So the Buddha was very resolute in not saying anything about what happens to an enlightened being after the death of the body. He says you can't talk about it. Language does not apply. You can't say that such a one reappears, doesn't reappear, both reappears and doesn't reappear, or neither reappears nor does not reappear. So reappears does not apply. So, and one of the most, I mean, that can sound like a bit, it's a bit befuddling and confusing, but the most, but what it's pointing to is an encouragement within ourselves to find that quality, that transcendent quality, and to not be just conceiving things in terms of a me, this sort of fixed me that was alive yesterday and is now this being here and now, and it will be alive tomorrow in some state of being. But recognizing, oh, that whole feeling of I in this place, in this time, this personality, that's woven together with a lot of assumptions. And that when we use insight meditation in particular and really develop that quality of wisdom, the whole sense of what I am, what, you know, what we are in our heart of hearts, that gets bigger and bigger and less defined. And again, to quote Stephen Levine, says, the further in you go, the more we overlap. He's very good with these nifty little sayings. So that the Buddhist meditation is, in a way, it's like a peeling away of the layers of assumptions about ourselves to discover more and more completely what we are at our core. And as we peel away those layers, what we find that we are is bigger and bigger and less separate from all the other attributes of the natural order. So in one sense you can say, yeah, being carries on, but then you can, but it's all, it's almost as important to say that we are, it's not being as this separate individual entity, but it's a whole quality of being that is, say, beyond what our conceptual mind and our language can really encompass. So that's why the important thing is to awaken to that quality, to realize that quality within ourselves and to know that, rather than just dwelling on a conceptual map of how things work passing through time. I'm not sure if that it makes enough sense to you or is helpful. Yes, yeah. But maybe there's also some other questions or comments in the room. Yes, please.
Can you say something more about the unenlightened, the being reborn, and the habits carrying on, that kind of?
Well, it's very much the same pattern that we experience from one day to another. One moment to another, like the choices that you made today, the things that you were interested in, the things that you were inspired by, the things you got upset with. You know, what you did today, what I did today, affects what's going on in my mind this evening. You know, so that the choices that we make, the things that we experience, the events that we see and hear and feel, they have an effect, and that effect carries on. So that to the extent that you maybe earlier on you were very you spoke very sharply to someone, you were kind of unkind in something that you said. So now you remember that event, and then you feel a sense of regret and a feeling of, oh, I'm so stupid. I keep blowing up, and I shouldn't be like, I've got a really bad habit of getting angry, and I shouldn't be that way. And so the mind taking hold of that event and identifying with it. Or maybe you did something very kind, you were very helpful, and you spent a lot of time looking after someone, and they didn't really ask for any help, and you gave forth that kind of generous act. You know, you acted in that generous way, rather than letting that pass by, you then the mind got hold of that and said, you know, I really did something good there. You know, I'm a good person. I'm a really helpful person. You know, I'm really developing a lot of good things in my life. You know, so taking a wholesome act and creating, you know, a kind of an ego, an inflated ego sense around it, or taking an unwholesome, an unkind act. Then either way, whether it's something positive, being helpful, that the mind gets conceited about and inflated, or whether it's a harmful, and the mind gets self-critical about, or self-justificatory. Either way, there's an increased identification with it. Look at me, I'm good. Look at me, I'm terrible. So I'd say that you're creating more karma around those acts, so that then what happens is that then right now, that has its effect. Tomorrow, it'll have its effect, that you'll experience the results of that identification and tending to do more and more of that in the future. The opposite effect would be if you spoke harshly to someone earlier today and as you were speaking, and then afterwards you realize, oh, that was really stupid. This is a bad habit I have. And then your mind, you recognize that's the way I tend to focus on that feeling, that experience. That I tend to make it into a personal problem. I'm not glad that I snapped at that person. I feel regretful of it. But there was an unwholesome act. There was a painful result. That's the way nature works. I'm recognizing and let this pain, this painful feeling teach me be a bit more mindful when I see that person who has that effect on me. Be more careful and attentive in the future. Okay, that's it. So then you let go of it. Even though it's an unwholesome thing, then you let go of it. If it's a wholesome thing, you're helpful to someone, not ask for any assistance, you put yourself out, you're very helpful, and then someone says, oh, you're so wonderful, you know, you're the kindest person I know, you know, you're a real blessing in my life, then you say, okay, well, it makes them happy, that's fine, you know, I'm just doing what's appropriate, no problem. Again, leaving it alone. So you're not creating any karma around that, not creating any identity around that. So, in the first instance, those first two examples, then the more that we buy into that, those habits, the more we identify with them, the more we strengthen those habits, and they will continue. And so we'd say that's a cause of, you're continuing the cause of rebirth, being reborn into those habits, day after day after day. The other is letting go of rebirth. Transcending that. Yeah, good things happen, painful things happen. This is the way life is. Not making an identity out of it. So we can see these habit patterns forming in the course of a day, over a week, or a month, or a year. So, and we see how we compound habits, compounding wholesome habits, neutral habits, negative habits. Or we see how we learn from them. And learn how to transcend them. So then the more that we recognize how that works, and the more that we learn from that process in our daily life, and we see that if we're wise, then we guide ourselves to more and more of an attitude of letting go, not being caught up, not identifying with the habits, positive or negative, then we realize, life feels really good. We feel a quality of wholeness, a sense of integration, a sense of balance, and people really like to be around us. And we are at ease in the world. So what happens after death, or what happens, say, between lifetimes, I mean, again, we address this somewhat in the Faith series. You know, it's open to one to believe in things or not. But the way the Buddha described it was exactly the way that these patterns function in our ordinary daily experience, our moment-to-moment experience, the cycles of habit. Just as they work within the course of a minute or an hour or a day, it works through through the course of lifetimes. When a body dies, then all of the things that, it's like when you go to sleep at night. If you're in a bad mood when you go to sleep, when you wake up in the morning, one, two, three, there it is. You scarcely got your eyes open before, boom, you know, there's the mood back again. So similarly, all the unfinished business and the habits that are there when we die, the Buddha said, yeah, that's what all the things that you're familiar with, you know, Mendocino County or life in Ukiah or being a woman or being an American or new kind of ordinary just things that are familiar, things that are painful, things that are great achievements or great regrets, you know, the whole spectrum, positive, neutral, negative. That to the extent to which the mind is identified with any part of that spectrum, that creates a momentum for that energy to find another birth, where those things that are familiar, suddenly you'll find yourself, you know, back in Ukiah. And it's one of those things that's a really helpful teaching that hatred is as an attractive force as love. So that if your mind is obsessed with aversion to something and hatred for something, that you get drawn to that, you know, as strongly as if you love them, you love that and adore it and are affectionate towards it. Be very careful. That Bush family could be pretty big in the coming ages. But in that kind of context, I often say that. It's like, be careful what you hate, because, you know, the Buddha said whether you love something or you hate something, that the mind will continually be drawn back to that. He uses the image, just like a dog tied to a post, circles around and around that post. whether we love something or we hate something, so too the mind will circle around and around it, tied to it, just like the dog tied by a chain to its tethered to its post. So be careful what you feel reasonable hatred for. So in a way, it can sound a little bit airy-fairy and mysterious, but it's really very practical. And so just as in physics, you have a law of conservation of energy, in Buddhist psychology, you have a law of conservation of consciousness. In fact, it's pretty bizarre, the idea that the body dies and then, you know, the mind stops. It's like, well, that's pretty strange, because the mind feels like a more powerful and real thing even than the chemistry of the body. So it's just basically part of the law of conservation of energy. And that if there's a momentum, then it'll just keep spinning until it catches and finds another place to go. There's a lovely book that's brought out by, I think it's Dharma Publishing. And it starts off with this: once upon a time there was a little boy called Narong, and he lived on a hillside in Tibet. And he's got this little boy with his furry booties and his kite, and he loves to fly kites. And then the next page is, and you turn over, it's sort of kid's book, and turns over the pages, and Narong got old and got sick, and then he died. So, hang on a minute, he was just a kid on the hillside with his kite. It's like the next page, there he is on his deathbed, you know, like. And then the consciousness of Narong then kind of disappears out from the body and then expands out to the sides of the universe. And then this voice comes to Narong and says, "You have two choices. You can either carry on into the clear light of bliss and merge. You can either merge with the clear light of bliss, or if you want to, you could come back. You could come back and be born again." Oh. Well, the clear light of bliss sounds kind of interesting, but tell me more about the coming back and being reborn. And then through the next pages of the book, it's brilliantly done and beautiful, beautiful paintings. Then it says, "Well, you can be reborn anywhere in the universe that you like. There's infinite choices." And he says, "Well, I kind of like that little patch of stars over there." And it's the Milky Way. He says, "Whoa, I kind of like that. Looks like an interesting area there." And it's the solar system. And oh, kind of that third planet. That looks kind of nice. Yeah. That, and it's Earth. then it's, oh yeah, well, there's all kinds of different creatures. I mean, four legs and six legs and hundreds of legs and no legs. And oh, it's kind of up in the trees and the skies and under the water. What? There's kind of the two-leg ones. They look kind of interesting. I like the two legs. Yeah, right. And then it's, and there are all kinds of different countries. And this, yeah, that one is the kind of, with the sort of white bits on the top and the kind of grey bits in the middle and the green bits down, but that's kind of nice. Yeah. That looks kind of interesting. And then the last page is, once upon a time there was a little girl, and she was she was called Lakpa, and she was she loved to fly kites. Doesn't that feel painfully familiar? So I see that 9 o'clock has mysteriously and magically come around. But as I've been sitting here, I was reminded of one story that I beg your indulgence. I'll just a short 3-minute story, 5 minutes maybe. So this was about 20 years ago. A child, was a child of one of the monastery supporters, died in a 2-year-old girl died in a very tragic accident. And there was a number of young families that were gathered around the monastery with young children. And so people were very, very shocked by this sudden death. She was in a car that blew up, spontaneously exploded. It was a stationary vehicle, little 2-year-old girl, and the car blew up. Anyway, so this was very much, the shock of this death was very much on the minds of everybody around the monastery, and it was very powerful. And so, for these young mothers, it was very, very hard to deal with, and they tried to sort of visualize their own children dying or being threatened, it was a big struggle. So then one night, one of the mothers, Kathy, had a dream. She's an artist. She's got very graphic, a lot of graphic skills, and had very graphic dreams. So in this dream, she woke up and she was in the bedroom of her home, familiar bedroom. It was a very vivid dream, and she woke up and she saw it was this the ordinary rooms and the ordinary walls and pictures of the room. And then she turned around, and instead of her husband in her bed next to her, there was death. You know, like skeleton, scythe, hourglass, the whole thing was lying there in the bed next to her. So she screamed, leapt up and hurtled and tried to get the door open. The door was closed, couldn't get the door open. Tries to find a place to hide. There's no place to hide. So she still huddles in the corner of the room and is in this terrified state. But there's nothing she can do. She can't hide, she can't go anywhere, she can't get out. And so she's in this shocked and terrified state, and then she's wondering what she can do, and then she hears this sort of strange snuffling, sort of sniffing sound, and then she realizes, that's the sound of crying. Somebody's crying. Who's crying? And she sort of looks up from her little huddled ball, and she realizes death is crying. She sees the skeleton kind of lying there in the bed, and this sort of watery tears running down the front of the skull, and the sort of sniff, sniff, moan, moan. So then, of course, she's a very compassionate person also. She got up and went over and said, what's the matter? And she said, everybody hates me. It's always the same. Wherever I go, you know, people take one look, just like you. They scream, they run, they... Can you imagine what that's like? Everywhere you go, people take one look and just sort of are shocked and horrified, and they run away, and everybody loathes you, no one wants you around. You know, it's horrible doing this job. I hate it. And then to her surprise, she felt there's a tremendous wave of compassion welling up in her. And she felt this tremendous affection. I said, yeah, it must be horrible, poor thing. And so then, even though the death was all there, kind of bony, with this dirty great scythe kind of sitting there, and she thought, no one's ever loved death. No one ever loves death. Oh, poor thing. And so she reached forward to embrace death. And she said, I couldn't quite keep my eyes open. I mean, it was because something in me was still a little bit shocked. So I closed my eyes as I was putting my arms around death. And then as I closed my arms to embrace death, I kind of closed my, as my arms, I kept expecting I was going to feel these sort of bony ridges and these kind of sharp edges, but it never came. I kept sort of half expecting to feel that, but there was nothing there. And I thought, what happened to... And she opened her eyes, and death had vanished completely. And as she, whereas the room had been sort of shadowy and dim, and all the curtains had been closed, she opened her eyes, and then it was bright sunlight, and then the windows were open, and there was a sort of beautiful spring breeze billowing the curtains, and the sunlight coming in the windows, and this great feeling of bliss. And then she woke up. She realized, well, if I didn't get the meaning of that dream, I really need help. So I thought it was a wonderful graphic demonstration of the spirit of what hopefully I've been able to convey this evening, and hope that this has been a useful time, and please take whatever has been useful away with you, and go well.